last night I danced with a stranger. But she just reminded me, you were the one. It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, and publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Ah, it's good to be back. How you doing, everyone? It feels like it's been a lot longer than it actually has been, and I tell you right now, it is good to be back in the hot seat with a microphone in front of me and headphones on my hair. What a weird way of putting it, but you know what I mean. It's been a while since we've dropped a new episode, but we have returned. The hurricane threw us all out of kablooey kabababloo, you know, threw us off schedule for a bit, but we are back and we are ready to roll, and boy, do I have some news for you right now about the Sundress Academy and Sundress Publications. Coming up this Saturday, October 22nd, it's a brand new type of offering from Sundress Publications, the first ever Poetry CrossFit. Yes, Poetry CrossFit. This is a unique little event that the Sundress Academy for the Arts is putting on this Saturday, October 22nd, beginning at 1 p.m. at Firefly Farms, the home of the Sundress Academy for the Arts in Knoxville, Tennessee. What is Poetry CrossFit? Well, it works like this. Poet Erin Elizabeth Smith will give you 5 prompts and 30 minutes. That's it. You have to write either a poem or a piece of short fiction about all 5 of those prompts every half hour. It's an intense little endeavor to get writers to think about beating the muse by beating the clock and how to write without over-editing. This is going to be a fun one, folks. For information on how to be a part of this, visit sundresspublications.com/SAFTA, S-A-F-T-A. That will take you to all the information about that, and you can also find it on Facebook by just typing into the top of your search bar, Sundress Academy for the Arts. Now, it's not just live events at Firefly Farms that are happening. Oh no, indeed, Sundress Publications, the main publishing outfit of Sundress, is dropping some new books. Indeed, we have had a bunch of new releases come out in 2016, and it's not over yet because we just dropped another one. We'll talk about that right now because it ties into something. Did you know we have a contest going right now on this podcast to help you catch up on a couple of those new releases? Well, we do. In case you don't know about it, during the month of October, all you need to do is write a review of the podcast on iTunes. If you do that and then drop us a quick message on Facebook or via Twitter, private message or whatever, and let us know that you did that, you enter into a raffle to win a copy of Mixmax Theater of Parts, a 2016 Sundress release, as well as At Whatever Front, the debut collection, recently freshly dropped to the public by Les K. Coincidence that Les K's book has just come out. We're running a contest, and he is our guest today on the program. Perhaps. Or perhaps it's a conspiracy. Now, it's not a conspiracy. There's enough conspiracy fear right now. Anyway, for full contest rules, just visit saftacast.com and look for down the menu bar, Listener Contests. It's a brand new thing. We decided to stick it in there so that you could find contest rules much easier. Anyway, back to where I wanted to go with this, and that is to tell you it is time for episode 62. Les K on the program, as I indicated, and it's an interesting conversation today. We catch up with him about things that have happened since we talked last on the program. Of course, to learn more about Les and to hear that first interview, you can find that on the SAFTAcast website at saftacast.com and click on past episodes and you can find his name on there. But today we talk about some other things. We talk about, of course, football because it is the season, but we also talk about some heavier subjects as well, as you will soon hear. Before you do, though, let's pay an ear to the theme song.
That and sort of lost track of time.
Totally cool, man. I know how that is. Doing work on a Friday afternoon, trying to get it done before the weekend. Yeah,
Yeah, pretty much.
So how have you been?
Okay, I guess. I mean, life is exciting and sad at the same time, right? I pretty much gave up on the academic market for this year. And I'm doing freelance work now, so that's kind of weird.
How so?
It's like going back to pre-PhD days, like before the recession. And it's just odd, that's all. It's odd to be doing this sort of work, copy editing primarily. And, you know, being at home, it's a little bit more difficult for me personally to, be more forward-looking.
Trying to be optimistic, in other words?
Yeah, I think the optimism is a little bit harder to come by.
I can see that, you know. I feel like coined the doors real quick, and that's, you know, I've been down so goddamn long, it looks like up to me.
Exactly, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think the key is basically to sort of like shift perspective a little bit, to recognize oneself as an artist and just, you know, do that and do whatever you need to do to get by.
Life can suck.
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, like, we lost our dog a while back, and, that was weird. Like, that was a weird experience.
Had you lost pets before?
Not something so meaningful as a dog, right? Like, I mean, I think that was the first dog that I'd lost. Like, I didn't have a dog because I grew up in apartments until I was an adult. So, you know, I'd never lost a cat or a dog or anything like that. A bird. Once, you know, smaller animals, which aren't anywhere near as big a deal because they're not as much a part of your life.
I don't know the lifespan of a bird, I'm thinking, but it's definitely a lot shorter and more intense than that of a dog.
Absolutely, and not just that. There's also the level of, for lack of a better word, intimacy, right? Like, a bird is not around you, like, every minute of every day, you know? Not in the same way that a dog is.
Dogs with their unconditional love.
I suppose so. Although I'm not entirely sure that love is the right word from their perspective. But devotion, following you around, needing you, absolutely.
Oh, my sympathies, man.
Well, I appreciate it. But what I was going to say, though, is that I think that, like, the loss of the dog, Ruby, who is, you know, there's a poem about her in my book, but I wrote that before everything sort of happened. It kind of put it into like a highlight for me, like this weird grieving process of, like, I guess, giving up or delaying like these peculiar academic dreams that so many of us have.
Did you find yourself kind of going through the seven stages of grief over Ruby?
Oh, absolutely. And we did some nice things to, like, you know, that are actually kind of silly, but like when we buried her, my wife put one of my t-shirts and a special treat in with her. And I read that poem that I mentioned before, right? Like, I guess at her graveside. And then the strange thing was, I guess one of the strange things was processing how the other dogs were feeling, because we had to do that too. And I imagine that their notions of what grief looks like are quite different than ours, because they are alien beings in a lot of ways.
But they definitely know something's amiss.
Absolutely. But and that's kind of what I mean, is the processing how they feel, whether or not they're simply tired, or whether they're approaching depression in the same way that I am, or whether or not they're thinking about, I don't know, the advantages that have come to them. It's just weird. It's odd the ways in which it's clear that they are feeling, right? It's clear that there is some lack there, but it's incredibly difficult not to project one's own, you know, human emotions onto that, and to think that, oh, they're feeling in precisely the same way that we are, that they're grieving in precisely the same way that we are.
Yeah, we interpret what they're doing as grief, but then we put the human definition of grief onto them.
Exactly, right? Like, I don't doubt that there was a kind of grief there, because the quote-unquote pack had changed, the dynamic had changed, the way that food was distributed had changed, the way that attention was distributed had changed, and the presences in the house had changed. And I don't doubt that there is an emotional component to that for dogs. Whether or not that resembles our own emotions, and I suppose the assumption that it so frequently does is to me, you know, I mean, that's kind of the height of egocentrism in a way. And yet, like, there's no way around it because that's just the place that we come from. Like, I don't know if there's any way around it, you know? Well, yeah, and there's some emphasis from her.
Perfectly timed on her part, letting her feelings known. I totally agree with that, Les.
Yeah, you see, but you see there, like, we're totally interpreting it, right? And I don't think that's what she wants. I think she wants out. I'm trying to get her to calm down. Hey, go lay down on the bed. Go on. Okay, maybe that'll work. If not, I'll have to be like, hey, can we pause for a second? Yeah, they get demanding, and that one in particular. Yeah, she's not taking no fun answers. Sorry about that. Give me one second. Go on.
But again, condolences on the loss of a pet, man. I know how that is. I had a golden retriever for 11 years, Dylan, and he died like it was 5 months after I left for my PhD. Mm-hmm. He was doing really poorly, and I came home that summer to get some more stuff to come bring to my new apartment and such and bring it out of the house. And he had stayed alive long enough for me to come home. And the first week I was home, I had to put him down. But he stayed alive long enough to see me one more time. Dogs are amazing. I forget who said it, but we are not worthy of dogs.
Yeah, I think I agree with that sentiment. And, well, you have my condolences for that story. That's heady stuff. And it is, yeah.
It's amazing how we process grief for humans and for animals that we love.
Mm-hmm. I also think that's one of the difficult things is that we're talking about it now, but I think that when a pet dies, there's such a peculiar, I guess, cultural way of looking at it, right? Like this grief is somehow diminished because it's not a human grief or because the person that we've lost is not human. And yet, you know, I mean, like, you think about your dog, you think about Dylan and the amount of time it spent with you, the amount of time he altered the way that you went about your daily lives. And in some cases, it's significantly more, right, than, you know, like a parent who you haven't seen in a long time or even a sibling that you're not necessarily, you know, always with. Like a pet is someone, something. Particularly if we're talking about cats and dogs, again, with birds, maybe not so much. Simply that presence, right, and adjusting to that presence not being there is incredibly difficult, I think. And it's weird how little we talk about it, right? Like, I mean, if you think about, like, the cliches of beginning writers, like, I remember that long list of stuff that I was told not to do when I started was, you know, you don't write about your dead pets, because even though everyone from a particular sort of class and ability to have that has experienced it, it's something that we don't really talk about, that we don't really engage with. And when we do, it gets engaged with in these sort of, I can't think of the word,
you were saying diminished, you know, I'll add to this maybe, the sense of, well, you can just get another one.
Yeah, yeah. That was the advice that my father gave me. Like, my father actually, he lives in Texas, and he actually works for a kennel, like a rescue. And he was telling me that they have a beagle there. And I was saying, I loved Ruby. I adored her so much. And she was a beagle. But there's no way in hell I'm getting another beagle. Like, in retrospect, like, all of the things that, like, I really adore about her, the things that make me laugh and smile now, are those indications that in some ways she was kind of a horrible dog. So why would I want to replace that? You know, I mean, it made my life difficult. But, you know, in that difficulty, I suppose something beautiful came along.
You can't replace dogs and cats, especially their personalities are so pronounced.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Like they have personalities that kind of align with breeds and then go beyond that. I think of each of my dogs as an individual, right? I think of every dog that I've ever met as an individual. And I think the same is true of cats, although I have like less living experience with them.
How are you? Yeah, this was a couple of months ago. I follow you on Facebook. I know that Ruby had been sick for a long time and the process had been a very long process with her. Mm-hmm. And how are you holding up now? This was a couple months ago. I'm not trying to diminish your grief in any way. Just how are you holding up right now about it?
Oh, I feel like I should explain a little bit about Ruby. Like, her health was sort of bad almost immediately after we got her. I think, like, my second year in a PhD program. So coursework was just ending, right? At that point, she hurt her back, and she hurt her back pretty badly, and to the point that ideally we should have gotten her spinal surgery, but we couldn't really afford it at the time. And we really thought that she would have to be put down from that. But somehow, through the magic of steroids and her tenacious will, I suppose, she got through it and had a pretty good life for a long time after that. Like, when we would take her to the vet for a long time and they would do sort of the evaluation of the dog, how healthy is the dog and like what's her coat like and all of those sorts of things, she would never ever get that the good condition, right? Like, it was always like poor condition. That was kind of it was her, because she was a stray and we got her from a shelter. You know, I mean, she had a rough life. Like, she had back problems, she had a heart murmur, she had bad teeth, she had sort of tattered ears, she had, like, all of these problems. And yet, she was still mean and ornery, and she really loved me. She was really attached to me, and she was happy, you know? I mean, she had those moments of happiness, a lot of moments throughout, like, you know, some constant pain. Now then, a little bit more recently, like, she had some problems with her bladder, and she got diagnosed with bladder cancer, and we thought that would be why we had to put her down, and we were working on starting treatment for that, and so we thought we had a few months with her, and this is more recently, and then she started having sort of fainting spells, and fainting spells for dogs are nothing like they are for people. It's a far worse condition because it points towards sort of cardiovascular impairment. And like I said, she'd had a heart murmur for a long time. And I think that, like, maintaining her health and sort of all of the different sorts of drugs that she had to deal with, and then the additional, like, impact of bladder cancer, like, it must have done something to make that heart even weaker. And then that was the point when we couldn't keep going, you know, when she, I guess the way that we put it is she couldn't really enjoy a cheeseburger anymore. And so if she's at that point, then that's that. So, I mean, you can probably tell from my voice, to speak to your original question there, is that there's still pain there. And part of that is because of the love that was there and thinking about her, you know?
Things are progressing in a positive. They're trending toward the positive. It's just, it's still going to take a while.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's sort of the nature of grief, generally speaking, is that it improves, but it's always there. Like, to me, it doesn't feel like an almost physical manifestation anymore, right? Like, sometimes I'll expect to see her when I look in a certain direction or I'm doing something. But that's quite different from at the beginning, you know, where I would, you know, reach for treats and I would grab too many and would instantly think of her. Or, you know, when I would go to bed and she wouldn't be there beside my bed. Or when I would sit outside and she wouldn't be there.
I know the feeling. You mentioned Dylan, and it's, 7, 8 years later, and yet every time I go home, he's buried in my backyard, in the garden he loved to tear up. We could never plant anything because of him. So that was his gift, was when he was cremated, we buried him underneath that garden. So
that's lovely, Scott.
But every time I go home, I make sure, even in dead of winter, if there's a foot of snow, I'll go out back and go to the spot. I know exactly where it is in the garden and, talk out loud to him. And tell him I'm home, and then I miss him, because deep down I still do.
I also think that's one of the interesting things about, grief. Like, I found myself doing similar things, like, every once in a while I'm going back and talk to Ruby. Even though, personally, from my worldview, I know better. I know she's not there. I know that what's there is not Ruby. But it doesn't fucking matter. It's this thing that we do for ourselves to help us process what we're going through.
Helps us stay sane.
Yeah, because I suppose the alternative is far too bleak.
I don't even want to contemplate that alternative. No.
Do it in your poetry. That's what I do sometimes. And exactly. That's one of the great themes of art, isn't it? Right? And that goes back to the point that I wanted to make before, is that, what the fuck is up with Americans, with American art, that, we would say something like, no, you can't write about your dead pet, that somehow there's an expectation that that's going to be maudlin,
Thinking back on my CW training and education, I remember one of my professors saying, there's always room in this world for another dead grandmother poem. The question is what you're bringing to the table.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I do think that's why that creative writing instructors may sometimes bar a poem like that, is because sometimes it is just, the commonplaces that we tell ourselves, right? And that's kind of the problem, right? Is that the commonplaces aren't fucking enough. They're just not. Everyone knows that, but they're there for a reason.
They're what bond us.
Yeah, I suppose it's how you say something kind to someone who is clearly suffering that you cannot help, and instead of saying, "Dude, I can't help you. I'm around though, hey." That's kind of what it is, right?
Yeah, totally, man. So speaking, I feel like. I feel like we're going to get maybe we're helping other people. I'm here wow, all we've been talking about is grief and pets and loss. But so, I mentioned that I had a golden retriever named Dylan. And so, right now, the name Dylan is very much on the lips of many writers right now.
Yes, it is.
And so I want to ask you, Les, let's open the floodgate here. What's your take on Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize in Literature?
I fall firmly in the anti-Dylan camp. Now, before I continue, let me just say that I adore Bob Dylan as a singer-songwriter. I think he is a fantastic singer-songwriter, and there are Dylan songs, which, of course, almost everyone I know are near and dear to my heart. I also understand and appreciate the idea that lyrics and music, and I think that this is particularly true of hip-hop and rap, can serve some of the functions of the art of poetry. And I also agree with arguments that I've seen made that the genesis, tradition of poetry is deeply connected to music. The lyric poem itself started with a fucking lyre. Yes, I admit to all of that. However, since then, I do feel that poetry has transformed into something completely and utterly different, which is different from what Bob Dylan did. And I do think that in some respects, if you compare what Bob Dylan has done on the page to what other people have done on the page, I don't think it stands up. I also believe that we live in a time where it is easy, extremely easy, to not immerse oneself in books. And I feel like the Nobel Committee did a disservice to those folks who are working in print media by selecting someone who primarily worked in the performing arts. I think that pretty much sums it up.
I see where you're coming from, and that, for the most part, I agree with you. I respect him. You know, I've been a long-time Dylan listener, okay, mm-hmm. since I was 15 years old. Is everything of his good? Oh, hell no.
Oh, no.
I mean, I can go pull right away his song On the Road Again. I think it's just, it's stupid. It's horrible. Other times, he's good. I think he's overrated in a lot of scholars' minds.
Mm.
Much like Allen Ginsberg and many others. It's like, okay, I'm going to be honest here. I'm going to get some death threats for this one. Only about one-fifth of Nirvana's lyrics are good. The rest are crap.
Well, I have to think about that.
I'm going to be honest. You know, there are some great lines, maybe a couple great songs, but the whole doesn't add up. That being said, you know, I love Dylan. I love his music. When it's good, it's good. Is it Nobel worthy? No. I don't know. Have you ever had the experience in the classroom of students and lyrics and poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the things is that like poetry has completely become a different tradition than songwriting. I mean, like you can have a great song that will make you weep or make you dance with joy or whatever, but you look at it on the page and you're like, these rhymes suck. These rhymes are horrible. Like, you could not get away with that in a contemporary poem and get it even fucking published, you know? And with Dylan, that happens all the time. But, you know, I mean, I want to be clear that this isn't to take anything away from Dylan. I think it really is like a generic question in some ways. It is about genre, right? Like, he's already an icon. He doesn't need any more of our praise. Maybe Ann Carson does, you know, or Alice Notley totally does. You know, I would rather see more people reading Murakami on the subway than, you know, more people listening to Dylan on their iPods.
iDevice.
Yeah. Pause there. I'm like, which one do I want to talk about? Are there still iPods or is it just the phone now? I don't know.
It is just the phone, sadly, and which breaks my heart. So I'm holding on to the iPod I have until it is dust.
Mm. Yeah, my wife just got, like, from eBay, like, one of those big iPods and it was a crazy amount of money, too. Because now the iPods with the big hard drives are worth more because they're not around anymore.
Apple decided that, oh, we don't have the parts to repair them. Bull. Bull.
Yeah.
Creating artificial scarcity. But
oh, that's their business model, man.
Oh, yeah. That's how they operate. But, you know, we can get really cynical. And actually, cynical is what I think of the Nobel on this one.
Mm.
I feel like this is them saying, hey, people look at us as very highbrow and, like, what does this... You know, the Nobel in chemistry, let's say, of the last 3 years, how does, you know, the common man is looking at it going, how does this help? You know, I don't get this. So for literature, why don't we give it to somebody well-known, to the populace? I feel like it's a cynical PR move on their part.
I don't disagree with you, but I've been thinking about, like, even with my disdain for the selection, right? Like, I've been thinking about it, and it's a fucking genius PR move. Because we are talking about the Nobel Prize in Literature, and I don't remember talking about the Nobel Prize in Literature this much last year or the year before. Yeah, I mean, that's like marketing out the wazoo. It's brilliant. And there's a way in which it, like, I don't think this is my own idea. I think, like, Tom Holmes said this on Facebook or something, but there's a way in which this kind of aligns with, like, the stance that they had about American literature beforehand when people were complaining, oh, why isn't an American getting nominated or rather winning? The complaint being that American poetry, American fiction is a little bit too insular, right? And this totally disrupts that whole idea of just how insular, I suppose, American writing is. You know, I mean, I saw a story that proclaimed Dylan as, like, I guess the greatest living poet, which I find a laughable claim, but that was from the Nobel Committee, right? I don't know. There's a bit of a smirk going on from the Nobel Committee, right? Saying that, like, oh, all your highbrow literature and here's your best poet, you know, this guy that, you know, never took a creative writing class in his life and was like a wandering troubadour.
So in other words, Americans have been mocking the Nobel Committee saying, hey, why not us? And they're like, oh yeah, 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 yes, definitely you.
So yeah, yeah. It's like a finger to the Academy in some ways, or a finger to the canon makers. I don't know. You know, I mean, it's funny. Well, it is really funny.
It is when you think about it like that. Now, that raises a question. Is Dylan canon?
Mm, yes, absolutely. I don't like the idea of him winning the Nobel Prize, but I have no qualms like considering him important to the canon, because his lyrics were essential to the 60s, right? Like, his lyrics did do things in literary movements that impacted others, right?
Joyce Carol Oates builds Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been on his song It's All Over Now, Baby Blue.
And that's just one example, right? And I think the number of poets that I've met that count Dylan as an influence in some way, shape, or form, right? Whether that's an influence that was like a gateway for them that took them to Rimbaud or something like that, or deeper into the Beats or something like that, I don't know. But, you know, I mean, you're 17, maybe you hang out with the, quote, wrong crowd in high school, you're listening to Dylan and you want to write poems, like, what's going to happen, right?
Shit, man, that's how I started listening to Nirvana. I'm not kidding. That's how I picked up the first time. I was like, I listened to Nirvana. I'm like, shit, this is cool. I'm going to try my hand at it. Yeah. Okay, my juvenilia is bad Cobain-esque lyrics, but still, you got to start somewhere. Let me ask this question of you, Liz. Where was that for you? What was your gateway in?
Oh, my gateway into poetry? I don't know. It probably is related to song lyrics, but I don't have anyone quite like that. Like, I mean, when I was in high school, I was reading the Romantics a lot, right? And I would imitate Romantic poets and stuff like that. And, you know, I read Poe when I was little. I don't think I ever considered myself a writer, although I would occasionally do, like, you know, writing things until, like, I was out of high school or in high school, one of the two. But, you know, I mean, like, I went to college at Carnegie Mellon for, you know, physics was my major my first year. And I thought that's what I was going to be. And then I just decided, no, fuck this. I want to write poems. I don't know if I answered your question at all, though.
What turned you away from physics?
I don't think I could do it. Like, I don't think I was capable of doing it at that point in my life. I just wasn't. You know, maybe if I'd gone to a different school, that's what would have happened. But, you know, I mean, I didn't fare as well in chemistry or calc. Calc with linear algebra was the worst. I still don't understand matrices, and I never will. I guess that's one way to read it. But it's also that, you know, I just wanted to be a writer, you know. I wanted to have that kind of voice, and it seemed incredibly important to me. And I guess, I don't know, somehow that aligns with being like a working class kid that, like, you know, values knowledge over virtually anything else, that it was very easy for me to give up on a pragmatic path in a way that maybe isn't so easy for, like, middle class kids, right? And I'm not quite sure why that happens, but it does. I think that when I was at Carnegie Mellon, there was a lot of encouragement there, and I ended up being good somehow. I used to, and sometimes still, view poetry and physics as the same sort of thing. They're like two sides of a coin, if you'll excuse the cliche, in that they do try to get us to a better understanding of our world. And somehow it seemed to me that poetry was a more effective way of doing that.
There has been, for centuries, this long history of science and poetry finding common ground, intermingling with each other. I've always been curious about that. Why that exactly? Because on the surface, it doesn't look like they would combine.
Well, yes and no, right? Like, I mean, like, if you think about poetry and the way that poetry sort of functions, I mean, there is a mathematical element to it, right? And I think from the other side, like, science is about, like, looking for those precise and elegant solutions, right? Like, the more precise, the more elegant the solution is, the better it is, right? I think if you're talking about the pure sciences and something like poetry or short fiction even, those alignments are, like, really natural in some ways. I suppose that we could, like, go back into the deep history of the English language and point towards those moments when, I guess, science and poetry weren't quite so different once upon a time. The impulse seems to me, like, so very similar, just, like, such a different way of getting there, as it were.
Like, two different routes to the same end.
Yeah. I'm trying to go back to my physics days, and I'm probably going to mess this up, but, like, when you talk about physics and you talk about particle physics, like, one of the things, like, this idea that was, like, useful, I suppose, in particle physics at one point was, like, the idea of an eightfold way, right? Like, which was, of course, brought from Buddhism, but a way of, like, looking at, like, the different ways that, I guess, subatomic particles could possibly manifest. And they would always come up with, like, such, like, bizarrely poetic ways to describe it, right? Like, an eightfold way. Wow. That's kind of what we do in poetry, isn't it? Like, we take, like, that. I'm going to sound like, here my romantic roots come out, right? Like, we take that which is most mundane and make it, like, somehow marvelous, right? Like, such that other people can see it, such that other people can understand it, right? And in some ways, that's sort of what physics does.
We elevate the mundane to the divine, in a way.
I hesitate with the word divinity, but that's definitely in there, right? Like, I mean, sublimity, divinity, like, all of that is definitely in there, regardless of how one feels or thinks or believes, right?
A sandwich becomes something more than a sandwich in the end.
I suppose so. Yes.
Becomes a metaphor, becomes a metaphor for death, you know, in our hands.
Yes, I suppose so.
So, Liz, last time you were on the show, we forgot to check in with you at the end of the season to find out if your prediction about the Cowboys was true that year. But right now, you know, as a football fan and as the commissioner of the Fantasy League, of a Fantasy League, not the one, I should say. In all seriousness, though, what is the how are the Cowboys doing this year?
They've lost one game so far, and you know, to paraphrase Bill Parcells, you are what your record says you are. So, yay!
It certainly didn't look like the Cowboys were going to be at this position during the offseason.
I thought they could have been good during the offseason. It's just, when Romo went down, I thought they were toast, and I was wrong. Happily so.
As a Cowboys fan, yeah. I'm shocked at my team. You know, Buffalo is, like, is okay right now. Like,
mm-hmm.
They're fighting for first place, and they're 3-2, and I'm sitting here going, really? Huh. Well, usually I just expect you guys to suck. I have no illusions anymore.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the fan base that I most root for, outside of the teams that I follow, it's like Cleveland and then Buffalo. Like, I want those teams to do well just for the sake of the fans. And this year, of course, Cleveland has, wow, they've had so much bad luck that you can't even, like, feel bad for them, right? It's past that point. But Buffalo, they're doing really well despite an offseason that looked, like, really sketchy.
And an opener that looked real sketchy to the point where Rex Ryan is on the get ready to pack your bags list. And I'm like, well, you're out. What are some of the biggest surprises this season in the NFL in your eyes?
I don't know. I think the fact that the Patriots managed to get to, what is it, 4-1 without Brady? No, 3-1 without Brady. I think that was a surprise. I think just how unlucky Cleveland has been a surprise, because you expect them to have bad luck, but not that much bad luck. The Cowboys has definitely been a surprise, and that's in large part because of the play of Dak Prescott. I also think that along similar lines, the play of the Eagles and Carson Wentz, another rookie quarterback, has been a shocker. And then I guess on the negative sides, there's things like Carolina. Cam is out now, and they're not doing so hot. The Falcons are in first place in that division, which is amazing. And I don't know. That's all I can think of off the top of my head.
I'm surprised that the Giants – well, no, I'm not really surprised that the Giants having their issues. They really go up and down.
Now, the Giants is that team that, like, you look at them all year and you're like, that team is mediocre to slash suck. And then at the end of the year, they'll go on a run and they'll kick your ass.
Yeah. Which is exactly the opposite, now that I think of it, of Eli. Eli has always been the quarterback where if he throws an interception, he gets rattled and can't recover.
Well, that's interesting.
And I watch it, I'm like, come on, man, get back into it. You can do this. So what do you see for the Cowboys this offseason? Let's get the prediction here, and we'll check in with you in January. Do you think they're going to make the offseason this year?
Yeah, they're going to be in the playoffs. I think that when you have a first quarter as good as their first quarter, like, that pretty much sets you up. So they're going to make the playoffs.
Are they going to get division, bye round, or are they going to be wild card?
I think they'll win the division. I'm not positive, but I think they'll win the division. I think they can beat Philly.
We will see, though, as we get closer. Of course, a lot of things can happen between now and then.
Absolutely.
So let's talk for a couple minutes, though, about the new collection. You've dropped a couple of mentions toward everything. It's just dropped this week.
Yeah. Absolutely. I just got my copies on Wednesday.
Most excellent at whatever front. Where's the title come for that? I'm curious.
Okay. That's actually a really long and complicated story. I worked on this collection for a long time, and I had like several different working titles on it. The title itself is from a poem in the collection, a poem called E4. That imagines a child playing with G.I. Joe figurines, right? And playing with them in the most disturbing way, right? And I imagine it's a way that, even though it's disturbing, aligns with the experience of a lot of younger boys. Because I know I did some of those awful things to my G.I. Joe figurines. But the title is from that poem. And there's a line that he would raise them from the dead and barb them at whatever front or something like that. I don't know. I just butchered the line, I'm sure. But the title, as it is now, comes from that poem. The idea of fronts recurs throughout the collections. I think that's one of the things that unifies it. And Fronts was a previous working title. And before that, the collection was called Homefront, and there's a poem called Homefront. But a book came out earlier this year with the same title, and so they just beat me to that title in a lot of ways. And before that, I called it Fronts at some point, because there are multiple fronts in here. That the collection deals with, like, the fronts at home, as well as, you know, the idea of a front when you're talking about war. And then, you know, before that, I think I called it Subject to the Logic of Dreams for a long time, which is it's a great title for a poem, but like a really horrible title for a collection. And so I'm glad I got talked off of that at some point. That would be like one of those, like, I don't know, one of those books that, like, Subject to the Logic of Dreams, like one of those books that would be like at the intersection of New Age self-help and poetry, right?
Yeah, almost like a psychology book.
Yeah. But I like the title now. I like how it points to the variety of different fronts that we are facing right now. And I think that's becoming weirdly clearer now in disturbing ways.
So you've been working on this collection for a while now. How does it feel to finally see it in your hands and physically out of you, so to speak, and now in your hands in this format?
Well, I think in some ways, let's start with this, the more surprising responses, because of course it's fantastic to have the collection and all of that, but it's also a fucking relief, right? Like, it's like, thank God the thing is done, right? Like, thank God it's a book and there's no, like, I don't have to fucking deal with it anymore, you know? I mean, of course, there are poems in here that I think are amazing. I think that everyone should read. But when you put that much of yourself into a project like this, there is a point where you just have to be like, oh, thank God it's over. And I think that that's kind of what writing is like, right? Like, that is what a book project is. You know, I mean, like, George Orwell, I think, said at one point that, you know, like, writing a book is a horrible experience, right? And it's never as good as you think it's going to be. This is from George fucking Orwell, right? But it is. It's kind of like, it is a difficult experience. It is a lot to go through. It is a lot of work. It's hard work to get the poems, right, such that they're as close to perfect as you can imagine, right? I don't want to be too negative here and suggest that it's not worth it, because I think in a lot of ways that it is, that we put that much into this work of art with the hope that maybe it can impact someone somewhere.
But at the same time, now I can take a nap kind of feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Or not necessarily a nap, but now I can move on to the next one, you know?
It's like clearing your mind. Okay, that one's done. Now the next one.
Yeah, what's the next project and how do I want to approach that?
What you got, you know, obviously the book is out right now and just came out, and of course, you know, available through Sundress and this podcast, you know, we will be giving away a free copy on the show.
Oh, nice.
Of course, those who are listening just heard that a few minutes ago. Anyway, beyond that, though, do you have anything coming out right now or about to come out in the near future, anything out there, or is it kind of just like we're working with the book right now?
Nah, yeah, I'm working with the book right now. I do have some broadsides of a poem from that book that are for sale. You can go to my website and find that. And, you know, aside from that, there's not a chapbook or a book on the horizon as yet. I'm basically working on a couple of different projects, one which was my dissertation and looks at the recession from the perspective of one, that is the Great Recession, from the perspective of one family. But that book still needs work before I feel comfortable putting it out there. And then, you know, I mean, when I'm doing just writing, like I've been writing a bunch of self-portrait poems lately. And the next one I'm going to write at some point, if I can get past this copy editing, I think I'm going to write about maybe self-portrait as a Veritech fighter. So for those of you who know Robotech,
could be interesting. We'll have to see what pans out from there. You mentioned the website a moment ago. Where can the folks find that website, and where can they find you online?
Oh, my website is leskay.com. There may not be a link to my store there yet, but there will be at some point soon, I promise.
And of course, you are on social media on Book of the Face, you know, Facebook.
Primarily Facebook. Facebook is the best way to find me. I'm afraid of Twitter. I don't know why, but I'm still afraid of Twitter.
I don't think you need to say why. I think a lot of people can guess.
Yes. And it's not just me, man. It's not just me. But no,
there's a lot of people afraid of it. Les, it is always a pleasure to chat with you on this program, man.
Indeed. Thanks for having me on again, Scott. I appreciate it. That was some heady stuff. And best of luck to you with your Bills and also with your fantasy football team. Please keep setting your lineup.
I will do well in my league. I hope you do well in yours as well.
No, just keep setting your lineup so that when people go through you, it's not a walk, right?
In any case, best of luck to you, and we will see if your prediction comes true. I have it written down that they will be division winners in the playoffs. We shall see what happens. Until then, though, Les, take care, and, you know, continue to be awesome, man.
All right. Thank you very much, Scott. The same to you.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.